supposed to be given by Lale Sadegian, but her visa is not approved yet, so she's still waiting for it and she couldn't come. But I'm hoping she is on the phone. Is she?
Yes, I am, if you can hear me.
Hi, Lale.
Hi.
Very good. So all the credit for the talk is hers. All the mistakes in delivering it are mine. And she can answer questions about especially the strong gravity regime test that we are planning to do with ligand bingo detectors. So we all know about the weak field test of GR, the very successful test of GR, with the bending of light, Mercury's orbit, lensing, which is actually the prettiest of all, even the more practical ones like gravitational redshift that we use in GPS. And they are all very successful, as we all know. So these are big part of the reasons we believe in GR. But they are all in the quasi-stationary, quasi-linear weak field regime. Now, there are also strong field tests, like the losing of energy in binary pulsars to gravitational waves, that is already a strong test, dynamical test, but in the quasi-linear sector. There are also, as we heard in the last days, observations of black hole accretion disks and all sort of black hole tests involving supermassive and massive black holes that are in the very nonlinear regime, but mostly on the stationary sector. So with gravitational waves, we will allow tests that test the dynamical version, the evolution, the time variation of space-time in the nonlinear and strong regime. Now, you probably have heard of gravitational waves. You probably have your own opinions about plots like this. You might remember that we can calculate with a lot of math a formula for the distortion of space-time due to masses, to the motion of masses. We need a mass quadrupole, moment of inertia we called it when we calculated it as undergraduate, but we need it changing in time, and then the effect of that in space-time will be a distortion in the metric, which represents a change in distance divided by the distance. So even for experimentalists, this is a dimensionless quantity, not just for theory. But even especially for experimentalists, when you want to calculate this distortion, you need to use constants that are very unfriendly, g over c to the 4. So this is saying that the space-time is really, really stiff. It changes due to mass and motion of mass, even large amounts of mass moving very fast, but it changes very, very little. It also has actually a friendly factor of 1 over r because we are measuring field effects and not energy. So the amplitude of the gravitational wave decays as we go away from the source as 1 over r. Just like in electromagnetic waves, gravitational waves have all sorts of wavelengths, cosmological wavelengths, and those are most visible in the early universe, and that's the imprint in the polarization of the cosmic background that, me being an optimist, I hope we will see or have seen, or if we haven't seen yet, we will see really, really soon. There are lots of experiments with increasing sensitivity looking at that. We all know that there are problems with dust obscuring some of that. But also we are talking about direct detection of gravitational waves, looking at the effect of that distortion on the travel of light in space-time. So we can do that at galactic scales by measuring the timing of radio beams and the difference in timing in radio beams produced by those waves, and Javi will tell us about that later. We can talk about, we can measure gravitational waves on millions of kilometer scale, solar time scale, solar system scale if you want. And we could do that with space detectors if we ever convince NASA and ESA to go along and fast with this, although I should say that there is a launching date in 2034 for this project now. And what we are going to talk here is ground-based interferometers that are detectors on kilometer scale measuring hundreds of kilometer wavelengths. And the frequencies for this are in the 100 hertz, so these are audible frequencies. We want to say that we will hear the universe when we use these detectors. So the idea is just to use Michelson interferometers, that's a very old technique, to measure the quadrupolar distortion of space-time, which is predicted to have two polarizations. It is a quadrupolar distortion, so you do not measure a vector. What you measure is a distortion in two dimensions, and then we call this very unimaginatively plus and cross polarizations. Notice that because an interferometer measures the difference in distance between two distances, then it can be considered an optimal way of measuring these distortions. Now, just to give you an idea of how small these distortions are and how stiff space-time is, we all know, I showed you the Hertz-Taylor pulsar. We know it's losing energy. We know gravitational waves get larger in amplitude as the stars get closer and closer. By the time they coalesce, which will be many, many, many millions of years from now, they will produce a distortion in space-time and age of about 10 to the minus 18. And that's such a small number that means that when the Hertz-Taylor coalesces, it will change the distance between the Sun and the Earth by a bit less than a micron. And that coalescence happens about one every 40,000 years in our galaxy. So we are not going to wait for that. We have to look at longer distances, which means we have to look at even smaller strains. And this is something that people thought was impossible, but I'll show you that not only is it possible to measure these small distances, but we have done it. We have proved this is possible. So for binary systems, which is the one system that we know exists, we can calculate the quadrupole. It's not the only one that produces gravitational waves in our frequency band, but it is the one we like the best. I like the best, I should say. We do know the waveform in early times before coalescence, in what we call the spiral phase. We do know the merger now, recently, from numerical relativity simulations, even for systems more complicated than black holes, for example, simulations here by Lewis on neutron stars. And we do know what happens afterwards, ring down from perturbation theory. So we do know how the gravitational wave amplitude will change in time, which we can translate using Fourier transforms into the frequency domain. And this is when we use what's supposed to be the optimal method to look for this, which is matched filtering, which is taking the signal, the Fourier transform of the signal from your detector. The detector always produces some noise that includes, hopefully, sometimes, some signal. So you take that time series, you calculate the Fourier transform, you multiply that by the Fourier transform of the signal you're looking for, you divide by the noise spectrum, by what is the average noise that you expect at each frequency, and I will show you plots of this, and that gives you what we call the signal-to-noise ratio. The higher the signal-to-noise ratio, the more likely you are of finding this from an astrophysical effect and not just by chance. In principle, if this is a Gaussian, in the absence of signal, if this is a Gaussian process, then this is the optimal way of finding a signal, and you can assign a probability to any given signal-to-noise ratio. In practice, our noise is very non-Gaussian, so we have to apply several other tricks, but let me tell you that those tricks are actually quite successful. I can tell you more later if you want, but we will not go into those technicalities. Now, there are, as you probably know, not just detectors in the US, there are two observatories in the US, 4 kilometer Michelson detectors. They're quite a bit more complicated than Michelson detectors, and Mike Landry has a poster outside who has a more thorough description of this. But we also take data, and we have taken data in the past with a Virgo detector in Italy, which is 3 kilometers long. We do have another detector in Germany, GEO 600. The LIGO Scientific Collaboration looks at the data from the LIGO Observatory from GEO, the Virgo collaboration looks at the data from Virgo, but we all collaborate together. This is actually something that is a bit different, I think, in our field and in other big physics fields, that we are very collaborative. We actually combine our data sets and look for signals together, not just compare results from different detectors. We also think the future is going to be bright. There is another 3-kilometer detector underground being built in Japan, and there is another detector that was going to be built in Hanford to be moved to India, who is about to begin the construction of an observatory there. So there is a big global network. I'll show you details of the LIGO detectors, which is the ones we are most familiar with. Now, this is not only about gravitational waves. We all know that these gravitational waves are, we hope, are coming from astrophysical, violent astrophysical phenomena, so they will have some different electromagnetic signatures. So we have already done in the past, but we are preparing much more systematically a communication system so that even from the beginning, which I will tell you very soon, we analyze our data and we get event candidates, we will release these within minutes, within tens of minutes perhaps, but a very short time scale, to partner observatories and astronomers who will look for those signatures in the very poorly localized regions of the sky that we can give, that we can get by triangulation in our detectors. That's another reason why collaboration is good for us, because we can triangulate better the more detectors we have. Now, I told you that I was going to show you that we have realized this incredible sensitivity. This is a noise curve that is the square root of this power spectrum that we have to use to scale, to calculate the signal to noise, of initial, what we call initial LIGO detectors. So green is in 2007, red was in 2010. Those were two of the two latest and longest data taking runs that we have done with LIGO. The solid black line was the design, and you can see that not only we achieved it, but we surpassed it. Remember that this is noise, so lower is better. This is our best sensitivity. And we want to do more. We took data from 2005 to 2007, to 2010. We analyzed the data not only for binary systems. We looked for all sorts of gravitational waves. And we keep looking, but we haven't found anything there yet. But we knew that. We knew that probabilities of detections were small, so we need to do better. We need to do advanced LIGO. And that is what's around the corner. It's actually there. At low frequencies, this noise is dominated by seismic noise, and with better seismic isolation, we're going to go down. At middle frequencies, we are dominated by thermal noise, that is the Brownian motion of the systems in our detectors, and at high frequencies, we are dominated by quantum noise, which in experiment we call short noise, but it is actually quantum noise. So something I like to say about this spectrum is that it shows we are doing fundamental physics because we use all the physics constants. We have big G in here, we have Boltzmann constant in here, we have Planck's constant in here, and we are looking for gravity, so we have the speed of light, killing the amplitude of our gravitational waves, but it's also there. So in advanced LIGO, we hope to achieve a sensitivity that's 10 times lower, but also much lower frequency, which gives us more time to integrate the signal. We can integrate this in spiral phase from an earlier time. So we can integrate this for a longer time, and that gives us even more signal-to-noise ratio. I said that we have taken runs in the past. S5 was 2005 to 2007. S6 was 2009-2010. And these dots in here, and I have to say that Lale produced this plot, and it's very nice. It shows the sensitivity of the detectors from the time we first locked them, we first operated these resonant cavities, put every mirror in place, and you can see that it took several years until we achieved our design sensitivity. And then we improved it a bit. Now, since then, we took those detectors apart to install in the same vacuum system the advanced LIGO detectors. We are now about to start taking data with those. And Virgo is there about a year behind. So the idea is that we are going to see 10 times farther. That means that we can see a volume, a volume that's 1,000 times larger. So that means that our detection rate that used to be about one every 50 years for binary neutron star coalescences in our initial LIGO detectors will become tens per year when we achieve this advanced LIGO sensitivity. But of course, it's going to take us a little while to get there. And again, Mike here is an expert that can tell you more about that. But we are almost there. I'll show you more details. This is a Stroman plan of our expectations, and they start next year already. We think that next year we won't be 10 times better than we were before, but we'll be 2-3 times better than we were before. We like to measure our sensitivity in distance, average distance to binary neutron star systems. In initial LIGO, we had 15-20 megaparsecs. And here you can see a plot of the expected number of events, which has a very large uncertainty range, versus this number, this distance in megaparsecs that we call range. So in initial LIGO, we were here, so we expected zero events, I mean 0.05, but that's close to zero. Next year, we expect to be around here at 60 megaparsecs. So that's still not likely, but it's possible. And of course, we could be better, we could be worse. We don't know what we will be. We are progressing very fast. In 2016, Virgo will join, and LIGO will be better. So we will take data for a bit longer. And that's going to be around here. We plan to be around 100 megaparsecs. And in that run, in 2016-2017, detections are possible. Again, the uncertainty range is very large, but that means that even if we don't see anything, we are beginning to really, really constrain population models for this system. And this is only for binary neutron stars. You have to add to this black holes and binary black holes and black hole neutron stars. And then, of course, we will keep improving. And here you have the range of predictions for those detections. Again, this is guessing the future. Okay, let me show you again very quickly that recent news. The Livingston LIGO detector has logged. It has been in resonance with about twice the sensitivity it had before. This is what we expect to be more or less next year. This is where we are now with that detector. Of course, Hanford detector is following soon. But things are going very well. Now, GR test in the last 5 minutes I have. if you plot strength of gravitational waves versus curvature strength versus field strength, then there are many ways of measuring these. But you see that most of the tests that we have currently are weak field tests, and the ones we want to do and LISA are strong field tests. That's where we are going. We can do other qualitative tests, like measuring the speed of gravitational waves, which we all assume it's the speed of light, but we can measure distortions from that. We can measure the mass of the graviton, which again, we assume it's massless, but perhaps it's not. That has to do with the polarizations that we have, whether we have plus and cross or other ones. And we can look at mathematical solutions. That curved solution explain the geometry of the black hole. Of course, all these tests depend on what you measure and how well you measure it. But these are all things we are preparing to do. And we can do this because the Fourier transform of the signal predicted from GR is transformed in different ways depending on alternative theories that you have. And there's a zoo here. And then again, you can use all these different waveforms to compare which one matches the best. When you have a detection, again, the conclusions will depend on the strength of the signal, but there's a lot of tests of GR, basic GR tests that you can do with this detection. So summarizing, we have operated detectors at incredible sensitivity. We have measured distortions between 4 kilometers one way and 4 kilometers the other way to the 10 to the minus 19 meter precision, sub-nuclear precision. We have done that, we have proven that technology in the past, and we are improving it, and we are already on our way to have advanced detectors that will start taking data next year, but that will keep improving until we have this factor of 10 in several more years. I think detections don't need that factor of 10, will happen earlier. How early? It's your guess and mine, but we are all very optimistic on this. We have performed numerous gravitational wave searches, so we have the methods ready. Of course, we always come up with improvement of those methods, and Lale is one of the people doing those, performing those, investigating these improved methods, especially for GR tests. But we are looking forward to the observation of at least these compact binary spirals. We are looking for all sorts of other gravitational waves. We are looking forward to multi-messenger astronomy, comparing our signals to astrophysical signals to get the whole astrophysical, the new astrophysics of the universe that we will have with this new window. Thank you.
Questions?
So I'm always interested in points of synergy between all of these different gravitational ways to probe gravitational physics. And one that jumps right out at me is looking at the limits that can be placed on how cuspy the remnant populations around AGN, around supermassive black holes, could be. I seem to recall many years ago people making predictions, highly uncertain predictions, for event rates for LIGO and potentially other observatories that could, you know, vary by many orders of magnitude. And this is something that things like the EHT might be able to address in the next decade or a couple decades, just by watching the movement of the black hole under the action of all these remnants. But I wanted to ask you specifically then, at what point does non-detections by LIGO begin to dramatically constrain how cuspy those remnant populations could possibly be?
Well, that's a question that's a bit outside my expertise. Perhaps Lale knows more about that. I think that constraints about population of binary systems are very, very, very serious, and they affect other population models for growth of galaxies indirectly if we don't have detection. We do have searches that look for different configurations, in particular extreme ratio in spirals, if they fall in our frequency band, which is not so obvious. I'm not sure how serious the constraints can be. Lale, can you say anything more?
Oh, I don't think I don't have that much to add, but I just know that at least we can improve the upper limit by 4, but I don't have any number in top of my head now. Sorry.
We'll give it as a homework to the collaboration.
But yeah, that's a very good question. And probably people have worked on it. I don't know. I know that, like, for my specific case, which is like intermediate mass black hole, since there is no intermediate mass black hole have seen so far in the binaries, one of the main thing is just one single detection of those. That would be like by a huge amount improve our upper limits.
Okay, so I have one question. So it flashed there, but maybe a bit too quickly. Can you just describe a little bit about the possibility of sky localization as you go through in the different stages?
Yeah, let me. Actually, this is probably the best one. Localization we do by triangulation of different detectors. It's a bit better than that because the detectors being on different points on the Earth, they have different sensitivity to different polarizations. So it's a bit more than timing what we can do. But it's, it also depends on the signal-to-noise ratio of the signal, but it's not very good. In general, what we do is we make a sky map of probabilities, probability where the signals can be localized. And here you can see that, well, with two detectors, we don't even quote anything, because with two detectors, we will have a very thick ring. It's not uniform ring, but it's going to be a very thick ring in the sky. So we don't know whether you call that localization or not. If you measure it in square degrees, it's thousands. but once we have three detectors in 2016, we can measure the number, the percent of the events that we will localize with 90% probability within, let's say, 20 square degrees. And it's a small fraction, about 10% or less of those. And that is... These are not arc seconds, these are not arc minutes, these are square degrees. But that's why having the electromagnetic counterpart and taking into account false alarm coincidences with other counterparts, but that is what will give us the best localization and information on those, the sources of those. So we can constrain the masses, we can constrain the spins of these systems, the localization, not so much, we need help for that.
Okay, we're going to move to the next talk, but I have to apologize to Samir because he didn't ask us to thank him. So let's take the opportunity to thank Samir, Gavin, and Lali.